beginning now. Alors, mesdames et messieurs, ladies and gentlemen, s'il vous plaît, on va débuter. Bonjour, je m'appelle René Provost. Pour ceux qui ne me connaissent pas, je suis professeur ici à la faculté de droit et c'est mon privilège de vous accueillir au nom du Centre des droits de la personne et du pluralisme juridique qui, avec l'Association des juristes progressifs, organise cet événement autour de Omar Kader, avec un de ses avocats, Dennis Edna. Now, there have been many events over the years that have focused on Omar Kader's case. And there's a really simple reason for that. Even if you take every allegation against Omar Kader as proven beyond reasonable doubt, it still leaves his treatment as an undeniable injustice that has been visited upon him. And his case stands out as truly exceptional in the kinds of violations of fundamental human rights that we see associated with armed conflicts, but with the peculiarity that this time it is associated with a democracy with a solid rule of law tradition in the United States of America. Now, I want to take a moment to go back to what I think was the first event that dealt with Omar Kader at the Faculty of Law nearly a decade ago. When I was the director of the Center for Human Rights and Legal Pluralism, I was contacted by a Lieutenant Commander, Bill Keebler, who said that he would like to come to McGill to talk to students and anybody who would listen about Omar Kader's case. And I was a little unsure about what a military lawyer was going to come here to do and whether this was some kind of PR move by the United States government to say that everything was great down in Guantanamo Bay. And when Lieutenant Commander Keebler showed up, he was the picture of that PR man for the U.S. Navy, a very conservative looking guy. And then he opened his mouth. And then I realized how mistaken my skepticism or worries had been. Because Bill Keebler was not only blistering in his criticism of the military commission system at Guantanamo Bay, but for him, it was a deeply personal offense against the rule of law being so mistreated in the name of the United States Constitution. And if you spend time with American lawyers, or Americans generally, really, you know that the Constitution is something personal for many Americans, and for Bill Keebler it was particularly important and personal. And for over several years, Bill Keebler fought tooth and nail to defend the just cause that Omar Kader was due, regardless of whether the facts alleged against him were true or not. And he has paid dearly for it. He paid professionally. His career in the military was severely harmed by the vigorousness of his defense of Omar Kader. And ultimately, it can be said that he paid with his life. Because last July, just a couple of months ago, Bill Keebler died, age 44, from cancer. Part of a cluster of cancers amongst otherwise young and healthy individuals who had served in Guantanamo Bay and stayed in that part of Guantanamo Bay. And now the U.S. Navy has opened an investigation to see whether some of the chemicals in the ground are the cause of this cancer. So I wanted to take this opportunity to pay tribute to Bill Keibler, who really was a righteous man in forging ahead and doing everything he could, using his legal knowledge to advance the cause of justice. And we will hear more, of course, about Moncada and perhaps Bill Keibler from Dennis Edney. Before I cede the floor to Sibel Ataogul, who will, from the Association of Progressive Jurists, who will introduce Mr. Edney, I do want to signal that all of us are here today basically because of one person, and that person is sitting right here, and her name is Jess Adley. Now, Jess Adley was a law student here a little while ago, and I think it's a fair account to say that she let nothing stand in the way of this event happening. There were several things that stood in the way, and it kind of resonated with my experience of Jessica as a law student, too, that she didn't let anything stand in her way. So let me express thanks in all our collective names. To Maître Adley. So let me then cede the floor to Sibel Ataogul de l'Association des Juristes Progressistes qui va présenter Monsieur Edney.
Hi, thank you so much. My name is Sibel Ataogul. I'm from the Association des Juristes Progressistes. I think everyone can hear me, right? I'm very loud without a mic, so let me know. Just very briefly, I know you're not here to hear me speak, but very briefly on our association. It's an association of jurists. This means it's not just lawyers who are members of the bar, but law students, law professors, legal secretaries, technicians, anyone who's involved closely with the law. And our aim, we're kind of like the National Lawyers Guild, but on a tiny scale. And our aim is to try to inject a progressive voice into the legal community. So if anybody's interested, wants to join, just go on our website, www.agpquebec.org. I said I'm not going to speak for long. I just want to say a couple of words to introduce this vital event and a colleague who's an inspiration to us all, Mr. Dennis Edney. I was going to acknowledge that this is all the initiative of Jessica Adley, which was already done. We heard about it because a member basically wrote to us to say, why aren't you guys doing this? What's happening? So we said, okay, well, we'll get in touch with her and we'll try to help out. So thank you so much for letting us help you out. It's brilliant. And also the McGill Faculty of Law Center for Human Rights and Legal Pluralism, which is in its 10th year and which works towards advancing innovative research on human rights and the role of law in a legally plural world. And as we know right now, especially, this is not an easy task. Speaking of tasks that appear insurmountable, I have the distinct honor, I don't know why Jessica let me do this, but thank you, of introducing our speaker today, a man who is known to all of us as Mr. Omar Khader's lawyer, but who is, unbelievably, so much more. Mr. Dennis Edney, Queen's Counsel, is originally from very sunny Dundee, Scotland, and he completed his law degree at the University of Northumbria as, what I hear, as a mature student, which I think is brilliant. And he established his legal career in Edmonton and takes on cases, as we all know, involving criminal and human rights law, as well as cases under the, unfortunately, ever-expanding anti-terror legislation. He has seemingly dedicated his career to understanding and pushing the sometimes stifling boundaries of law to seek justice and to protect all of our basic human rights. This has, of course, led him down an arduous path, taking on notoriously difficult cases and winning many awards along the way, such as the Canadian National Pro Bono Award, as well as the British Columbia Human Rights Medal. This is just two of many, many awards. He is most famous for his very successful involvement in the case of child soldier and Canadian, Mr. Omar Khader, who was arrested at age 15 in Afghanistan and taken to Guantanamo Bay in 2002. Mr. Edney was appointed as a foreign attorney consultant by the Pentagon to take part in Mr. Khadr's defense. As such, he has appeared in front of all levels of court, including the Supreme Court of Canada, as well as the U.S. Supreme Court, and has thus represented Mr. Omar Khadr on a pro bono basis for over 10 years. What's even more inspiring is that him and his wife have offered a home to Mr. Khadr, thus fulfilling not only a condition of his release, but allowing him to experience all the solidarity, kindness, and family that they have to offer. We all go to law school, I should say some of us, because some of us really go to make money, but the good people all go to law school, no prejudices here, with the hope of using the law, the rule of law, and human rights legislation to do our part to make the world a more just and inclusive place. But oftentimes in practice, we see that it can be nearly impossible to equate law with justice. It's easy to become cynical and give up, which is why I want to thank Mr. Edney for being an inspiration, a beacon of hope in these very dark times, for teaching us the only way to win the struggle to make the world a better place is to never give up. So please join me in giving a very warm Montreal welcome to Mr. Dennis Edney.
Believe half of what you hear. So I want to first of all thank you for inviting me here today. I do apologize that I'm not speaking French, but I do, on my behalf, will tell you that both my brothers married French girls, and so therefore I've contributed to the language in some way or form. And I also wish to particularly thank three wonderful individuals, Jessica Adley, Natalie Drouin, Genevieve Rochette, for their assistance in promoting the Omar Khadr story. They have initiated the Poor Omar Khadr website, have coordinated the writing of a beautiful poem, and generally are working round the clock to raise awareness about Omar Khadr and his story. And I also understand one of the preeminent filmmakers of his time, Patricio Hernandez. Where are you, Patricio? Is filming this event. Patricio and Luc Côté directed a documentary, I'll try it in French, Vous n'aime pas de vérité, You Don't Like the Truth, released here in Montreal in 2010. And this documentary was the only film to use actual interrogation footage of Omar from Guantanamo. In fact, it took me 5 years of struggle to get that video. And it's hopefully it opened the door of many Canadians, the eyes of many Canadians. And I should tell you that this coming November, a new documentary entitled Guantanamo's Child is going to be showing here in Montreal. It's a very important film to watch. It was showing at the Toronto Film Festival and sold out. And it was even shown at the Calgary Film Festival and it was sold out. So it obviously has something to sell when it gets such adulation in such places as Calgary, Alberta. And I also want to thank all you McGill students for being here, and also the alumni and the faculty. Now that I've done this, I made this invitation, that's my talk tonight, and I'm going to move on. So, truly, the title of my talk is The Rule of Law in an Age of Terror. I will touch upon a number of themes, and hopefully, by the end of my talk, I will have challenged you to question whether the concept and the practice of justice is being carried out in your name. It is an accepted fact that the world today faces grave challenges to the rule of law and human rights. Previously well-established and accepted legal principles are now being called into question in all regions of the world through what I would suggest are ill-conceived responses to terrorism. Many of the achievements in the legal protection of human rights are under attack. Now, terrorism certainly poses a serious threat to human rights, and all countries have an obligation to take effective measures against acts of terrorism. Under international law, all governments have both a right and a duty to protect the security of its citizens. However, since September of 2001, many countries have adopted new counter-terrorism measures that are in breach of their international obligations. In some countries, the post-9/11 climate of fear and insecurity has been exploited to justify long-standing human rights violations carried out in the name of national security. And this has led to an intense debate over where the balance lies between the rule of law, human rights and civil liberties on the one hand, and security on the other. Former U.S. Secretary of State Madeleine Albright, on leaving office, had this to say about the appropriate balance. And I quote, "We have found through experience around the world that the best way to defeat terrorist threats is to increase law enforcement capabilities while at the same time promoting democracy and human rights." Now, those remarks would have struck many Western liberal audiences at the time as mainstream beliefs consistent with the rule of law and reflective of values which we prided ourselves on at that time. However, over the years, many Western democracies since 9/11 have reappraised the balance described by Madame Albright and exploited the climate of insecurity and embarked upon a politics of fear to limit civil liberties. Take, for example, the revelations that the Obama administration approved the NSA to secretly collect phone records and access internet records of millions of Americans. The NSA's activities are not simply confined to eavesdropping on terrorists and potential security risks, or even the heads of state or other powerful figures. It has spied on the everyday life of American citizens, capturing billions, if not trillions, of communications as it probes deeper and deeper into one's private life. And these activities have now raised new questions about the public or the American public's willingness to sacrifice civil liberties in the interest of national security since 9/11. And meanwhile, in Canada, in responding to last year's terrorist attacks, former, thank goodness, Prime Minister Stephen Harper just made me cry there, you know. Meanwhile, in Canada, in response to last year's terrorist attacks, Mr. Harper promised his Conservative government would not overreact. Unfortunately, his government proceeded to do just that. The recent 2015 Anti-Terrorism Act restructures our national security laws so drastically that it will take years before we understand the law's full effects, even with a change of government. We are now burdened with expensive, useless procedures that slowly erodes rights while giving the false impression of enhancing security. It feeds into the perception that people who have nothing to hide should not be concerned about this legislation. This legislation provides new powers to the Canadian Security Intelligence Service, CSIS, that fails to respect the safety and the privacy of Canadians. Instead of putting forward concrete measures to make Canadians safer and to protect our freedoms, that government put politics over principle and introduced a bill that is sweeping, dangerously vague, and likely ineffective. The legislation allows for unprecedented and excessive powers to CSIS to collect and share extensive personal information and details about its citizens, to permit Canadian citizens to be detained without due process, to place individuals on a no-fly list without notice or explanation, and the power to request a judge in a secret hearing for a warrant to break the law and violate any charter right as long as the judge signs that warrant, and all in a secret hearing, and all without convincing mechanisms to ensure that these powers are not misused. Under the cloud of exaggerated fear about the nature and the scope of the terrorism threat, we now have turned our domestic spy agency into something that looks disturbingly like a secret police force. Moreover, the Harper government's sketchy explanation for this legislation provides little understanding why the present system was in itself inadequate. In all its murkiness, the comment by the Prime Minister's office that, and I quote, judges have constrained CSIS powers in the name of preserving civil liberties, suggests then that judges were seen as the problem, resulting in and the need for such draconian legislation. And so I say to you that the view that the judiciary is an obstacle to public safety is not a novel one. The Bush administration, in setting out its national defense strategy in 2005, authorized the National Security Agency, NSA, to monitor phone calls and emails of American citizens, all without court permission. And he also blamed the judiciary. He stated, "Our strength as a nation will continue to be challenged by those who employ a strategy of the weak by using international media and judicial processes." And similarly, in Britain, former Prime Minister Tony Blair, on the point of leaving office, stated that it is a dangerous misjudgment to put civil liberties first. To do so was both misguided and wrong. And these comments by Western leaders, both past and present, are alluringly simple constructions of a subject matter that touches upon the very nature of the civil society we wish to live in. And their comments are also fundamentally wrong. In adopting measures aimed at suppressing acts of terrorism, it is not simply a utilitarian calculation of security at the expense of our civil liberties, or balancing the right to security of the many against the right of the few. We are fighting for more than the safety of our citizens, though that is an important objective. We're also fighting for the preservation of our democratic way of life, a right to freedom of thought and expression, and our commitment to the rule of law. Those liberties which we have been hard won over the centuries and which we should hold dear. In our commitment to the rule of law, we cannot compromise on long-standing principles of justice and liberty. It is only, and I suggest it to you quite strongly, it is only by adhering to the rule of law are we able to define the boundaries of permissible and legitimate government action. And to those who would place security at the expense of civil liberties, they could have benefited from the words of former U.S. Supreme Court Justice William Brennan. He said, "There is considerably less to be proud about and a good deal to be embarrassed about when one reflects on the shabby treatment civil liberties have received in the United States during times of war and perceived threats to national security. After each perceived security crisis ended, the United States has remorsefully realized the abrogation of civil liberties was unnecessary, but it has proven unable to prevent itself from repeating the error when the next crisis comes along." Now, I have used the word terrorist today for the sake of simplicity, but it isn't a particularly useful term as it provides little guidance. The international community itself has no single definition of what constitutes a terrorist group. It needlessly frightens people without informing them of anything important. There is no clear-cut and comprehensive definition of terrorism in international criminal law. Governments have used the term subjectively for their own policy objectives over the years. Politicians employ it to justify illiberal measures, and the panic that it provokes ramps up prejudice against minorities. It is even used to win support for wars. I say to you, it's one of the most toxic words of our time. And meanwhile, the phrase war on terror and terrorist has now become synonymous with Islam and Muslims in the minds of many of us. We have all bought into the phrase war on terror. It is an inaccurate term, a rhetorical device, a cynical manipulation of the public's horror after 9/11. The phrase war on terror has no more legal or practical meaning than would a war on cancer or a war on poverty. And the racial and the religious harmony we as Canadians once prided ourselves on is more tenuous today. And it's not helped with the relentless racist attacks on Canadian Muslims, including references to barbaric cultural practices, jihadi threat, and the endless hullabaloo over the niqab, all intending to exploit the baser side of our nature, the racist that lurks in all of us. And as a result, it is easy for people to accept that drastic measures must be taken in the interest of security, even if it means the suspension of civil liberties, compromising our values, or ignoring the rule of law. We just simply rationalize it's for the greater good of society. Can we now state with any conviction that we have become a more stable world, a more tolerant and compassionate society since 2001? The reality is that public anxiety has increased along with intolerance, discrimination, and bigotry. Since 2013, the overall number of reported hate crimes against religious groups fell in Canada, except for Muslims, who experienced a 44% increase, according to Statistics Canada. And one has to look no further than Guantanamo Bay to understand how easy it is for a nation to fall into lawlessness when it doesn't get that balance right. Guantanamo has been called everything from an offshore concentration camp to a legal black hole. It is a complex of brutal prisons where hundreds of men and youths from all over the world have been held by the US government under incredibly inhuman conditions and incessant interrogation. And when I say youths, what I'm referring to was that there originally was about 23 young kids in Guantanamo Bay in 2003. And Human Rights Watch was asked to repatriate all these kids. And they did so. The only name that wasn't on the table was that of Omar Khadr. And these descriptors of Guantanamo Bay that I have just stated to you should come as no surprise to anybody here. Because it was in January of 2002, you, your friends, your parents, your grandparents witnessed the first shocking images of detainees hooded and shackled for transportation across the Atlantic to Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, much as other human beings had been carried in slave ships 400 years earlier. And on their arrival in Guantanamo Bay, we witnessed, through the media, the humiliation of these anonymous human beings and loaded on the tarmac like so much human baggage to be transported to open-air wire cages that would be their home for many years, all without access to family, friends, lawyers, human rights organizations, or any semblance of due process or judicial oversight. In fact, there have only been 6 trials in all the years that Guantanamo has been open, and there's been over 700 detainees there. And the photos of detainees that we saw in orange jumpsuits, crouched in open cages, cuffed, hooded, and masked, while kneeling at the feet of US soldiers, became emblematic of how the US, the United States, intended to fight its war on terror. And for the watching world, which is you and I, no knowledge of international humanitarian conventions was needed to know or to understand that what we were witnessing was simply unlawful. This was not a manifestation of the Geneva Conventions at work, nor was it an act of deportation or extradition. It was far, far worse. It was the unlawful transportation to a world outside the reach of law, and intended to remain so. And in that world, crimes against humanity were to be carried out and continue to be carried out in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. I, for what it's worth, would never have envisaged that the history of the new century would encompass the collapse of moral order, the destruction and the distortion of fundamental legal and constitutional principles that have been in place since the 17th century. We appear to have forgotten the lessons of the 17th century Star Chamber, where the accused were submitted to torture, to accusations based on secret evidence, heard by a secret court, while being shackled in extremes of isolation. And the worst excesses of the past year should have sounded loud alarms, not the least because of that precise historic parallel to the Star Chamber. We are witnesses to habeas corpus being abandoned, secret courts being created to hear secret evidence, guilt inferred by association, torture and rendition nakedly justified, and vital international conventions consolidated in the aftermath of the Second World War, the Geneva Conventions, the Refugee Convention, the Torture Convention, and more, have all been deliberately avoided or ignored in the war on terror by many Western governments, including our own. And it was into this hellish world a young Canadian boy, Omar Khayr, was abandoned. And to those who may not know his background, he was 15 years old when his father left him in a compound in Afghanistan controlled by half a dozen or so Taliban fighters. His father promised to return and pick him up, but he never did. And U.S. soldiers on patrol came knocking on the door of the compound demanding entry. A firefight ensued, resulting in an aerial bombardment that totally destroyed the compound, killing most of the inhabitants. Then Delta Force soldiers then went into the compound to mop up any survivors. A Delta Force soldier, in fact, the chap in charge of this Delta Force unit that came into the compound, he gave evidence at Omar's kangaroo trial. And he said that he saw Omar away from the battlefield, facing a blank wall, screaming from his shrapnel injuries, and that he then simply shot him twice in the back. That act in itself, I suggest to you, is also a war crime. And miraculously, Omar survived. He was eventually loaded onto a military helicopter and regained consciousness 7 days later in a hospital at the notorious U.S. Bagram base in Afghanistan, better understood as a concentration camp. And on awakening, little did 15-year-old Omar Khayr realize his troubles had only started. From the moment he gained consciousness, he experienced conduct that can only be described as sadistic, blatant, and wanton criminal abuses. And at the outset, unable to walk due to his injuries, Omar's interrogations would take place at his bedside, with his hands and feet would be shackled to each side of the bed, and pain medication would be withdrawn in readying him for his tortures. And when his interrogators didn't like his answers, Omar's body would then be moved into stress positions, causing agonizing pain and reducing him to screams and tears. And at that time, his captors would then shine bright pencil lights directly into his damaged eyes to cause even more agonizing pain. Today, Omar is blind in one eye and partially blind in the other. And as Omar became more mobile, he would then be taken into an interrogation room where he would be subject to a smorgasbord of abuses, including physical, mental, and sexual abuses. And sexual abuses, I should say to you, we don't talk about it, I don't talk about it much, but it was systemic throughout Guantanamo Bay. And if you wish to think of some horrible, vulgar, sadistic sexual act, I would say add some more, because there was no limit to the sexual abuse that took place against Muslims, whom the interrogators realized had a certain sensitivity about their own sexuality. And while being subject to beatings, Omar would be threatened with snarling dogs, while a hood would be wrapped so tightly around his neck that he started to suffocate and panic, which was the sole purpose of the whole exercise. And he was also subject to waterboarding and a technique called water dowsing. It is a distinction without a difference. Water dowsing creates a drowning sensation while adding the element of freezing the detainee's body to the point of hypothermia. And Omar was also subject to what I describe as the crucifixion technique. And prior to his crucifixion, he'd be forced to drink lots of water, and then he'd be hung in a 5-foot square wire cage on a wall, all naked, for long periods of time, and then when he eventually would urinate on himself. And this then would be the signal, the joyful signal for his interrogators to untie him and use his body as a mop to clean up the urine and then carry out various sexual perversions simply to humiliate him. And a nurse who worked on the hospital ward in Bagram, when I questioned her, said, denied that any such activities took place, only to be contradicted by the evidence of an army medic testifying that he once found Kader chained to the door frame of a 5-foot square wire cage with his arms suspended above his shoulder, hooded and weeping. We have that photograph. I showed it to a college a couple of years ago, and it was so shocking I decided not to show it again. Former detainees that I am in contact with, particularly the British detainees, stated they would hear Omar sobbing in his bed after these interrogation sessions, but they themselves were helpless to help for fear of being tortured themselves or being severely punished. And Omar stated that there were many nights that he lay in his hospital bed in terror, listening to the persistent screams from other detainees enduring their own interrogations. It was then that I realized that every bed was a torture chamber. And Omar tells the story of a particular soldier who would regularly stop by his bed. And amongst other things, this soldier, in front of people, would drop his pants, stick his bum in his face, and then just fart. And while that was going on, everybody laughed. Just thought it was kind of funny. Such degradation of human dignity goes against the very core of humanity, particularly in what I would describe as a sacred place that a hospital is, where people are at their most vulnerable. And where were the voices of protest from those military personnel of all stripes who worked there? How were they able to suspend their moral and ethical training to participate in such barbaric and sadistic acts, particularly towards a child? In preparing for Omar to be coming to my house and to be released by the court, I contacted several former British detainees, whose names I will not mention. And I asked them what would I expect from Omar once he's living with me. And one of them said to me, you know, Dennis, we trust you. So I'll tell you this. When I put my kids to bed at night time, what he said, first of all, at night, nighttime is the hardest time for me, late at night when it's dark. And when I put my kids to bed at nighttime, I leave the house, I get into a car, I drive up the road, and then I start screaming. Another detainee that I know very well, actually, I go to London quite often because I do some work out of there. And there's this big, beautiful, broad former detainee, and when he talks to you, he goes, you know, I can't breathe at all because my nose got smashed in by a guard, and you know that I can't see out of his eye because one guard stuck his finger right through my eye. And he said to me that sometimes he just gets angry and turns around to his wife and says to her, "You have never been raped." The interrogation team that tortured Omar was supervised by someone you could check out on the internet, Sergeant Joshua Claus. And Claus acknowledged that he had interrogated Omar 20 to 25 times over a 3-month period for up to 6 hours at a time. And in questioning him, with a bit of a smile on his face, or maybe I just imagined it, he stated to me that he may have been a bit more robust with Omar than with other adults, saying that I particularly like children over adults. But that comment says something, considering the same Sergeant Joshua Claus was later convicted by the US military of killing one detainee, crippling two others, using the exact same techniques that he used on a child, Omar Khadr. And in mitigation before the military court that was trying him, Claus stated that he felt pressured to get results. And in a twist that only Kafka would have relished, Claus was then granted immunity by Guantanamo prosecutors in exchange for testifying at Omar's trial that Claus had tortured Omar to acknowledge that he had thrown a hand grenade. And the judge allowed that evidence in. And Claus, by the way, was treated with almost as royalty in Guantanamo. I was there when we all got off the plane for the trial, and there was Claus all dressed in black and greeted by all these soldiers like he was a hero. And the military judge not only relied upon his evidence, but showed the slightest disregard for how the confession was coerced, or any concern as to the physical and psychological condition of a 15-year-old child. What does this all say? What it says is that there were simply no boundaries to human rights violations carried out on Omar and other detainees. And we're all aware of it. Our government was aware of what was going on. There's nothing that I haven't said to you tonight that your government wasn't told by me and by others about Guantanamo Bay. In fact, at the same time, organizations such as International Red Cross, Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch report such violations were standard procedure, including physical and sexual abuse, torture, rape, and murder. Meanwhile, various governmental representatives, from the Liberal Party to Peter McKay with the Conservatives, persisted time and time again, and telling the Canadian public that they had been assured that Omar is being treated humanely and that they would take the United States at its word. Meanwhile, every other Western country was less accepting and demanded the return of their citizens, adults, each and every one of them, and it was granted. And whatever horrors that Omar endured in the Bagram Hospital followed him to Guantanamo Bay, as did Claus. Claus was so successful in Bagram, he got promoted to Guantanamo with his team and then went to Abu Ghraib. And many of you may remember the photograph of the U.S. female soldier smoking a cigarette, standing on a bundle of naked Muslim bodies intertwined on the floor in the Abu Ghraib prison. That was Claus's team. And Damien Corsetti is a former torturer who worked with Claus. And you could see him being interviewed by Patricio's documentary, You Don't Wish to Know the Truth. And he says things like, does Canada not get it? We did horrible, terrible things to that child. And all the while I've heard over the last 10 years, particularly when I'm going into court to argue by our government, that Omar Khadr is a murderer, a terrorist, committed a heinous crime, those one-line statements, without any background to why he pled guilty. And I recall my first meeting with Omar in Guantanamo Bay. He had been transferred from the cages to one of the three secret prisons that we never talk about in Guantanamo Bay. Just concrete buildings, windowless, and deeply silent. And the Pentagon, quite fairly and quite honestly, describes them as places for enhanced interrogation techniques, None of you need the translation. Obviously, we're talking about torture. And I recall the moment I first walked into Omar's cell. I observed a pale, ill-looking young body with every part of his body causing him pain and discomfort, all the while chained to a floor. He reminded me of a small, broken bird as he sat shivering in this windowless cell, trying to stay warm, as his cell was purposely kept cold so that the teenies such as Omar are never allowed to rest, to have a deep sleep, or to feel comfortable. And he had been detained in this solitary windowless cell in conditions of sensory deprivation for the past 18 months, with his only visitors being his jailers and his abusers. And it was 3 years, imagine this, it was 3 years after arriving in Guantanamo that Omar was even charged with a crime. And it was in those conditions that I first met Omar Khadr, and it was an experience that I suggest to you that it changed my life for the best, truly for the best. But I, at that time, I couldn't believe what I was seeing. I walked into that cell as a serious lawyer, lots of experience, but I was also a father, and I couldn't believe, and I recognized that my children were at home with their mother under the safety and security of her. And every time I left Omar Khadr after a visit in Guantanamo, I was aware that the fluorescent lights in his cell would remain on 24 hours a day, that he would try to sleep away the time, and that his freezing cell would prevent that sleep, and that the incessant lighting had divested him of his feel for what was day and what was night. And over the course of any given month, he would be subject to a variety of interrogations and never known when he would get a next visit from another sympathetic human being. The Canadian government often refers to Omar as a convicted war criminal and a murderer without any backdrop to his convictions, as I just said. However, the American Military Tribunal, you have to understand, that convicted Omar Khadr was not a normal court. It was a pantomime of justice, removed from the normal American legal system and relying upon made-up rules and novel legal interpretations. It's only very recently that General Martins, the newly appointed chief prosecutor in the military commission system in Guantanamo, acknowledged that the initial versions of the commission trials were flawed and unfair. He promised to put in a higher bar to hearsay evidence and a prohibition against using statements made during cruel or degrading mistreatment. That's his quote. However, the Alberta Court of Appeal put it recently in dryly damning language, stating the legal process under which Omar Khadr was held and the evidence elicited from him have been found to have violated both the Charter and international human rights law. And the Supreme Court of Canada recently said also as much. And yes, Omar pled guilty as part of the plea bargain. And before he pled guilty, it was made clear that unless he did so, he faced a lifetime of indefinite detention, regardless of the outcome of the trial. Something else your government didn't tell you. And at that point in time, he'd already spent a decade in American custody, held in places that were entirely removed from the realm of law, and where abuse and torture were standard operating procedures. And who amongst us, I ask you, would not have taken that plea bargain to escape that hellhole of waterboarders, torturers, and abusers? So as I conclude, our generation has had the most sophisticated development of international laws, treaties, and conventions the international community has ever known, all stating that human rights abuses will not be tolerated. And these international instruments include the Geneva Conventions, the Convention on Torture, the Convention on the Rights of the Child, and many more, all applicable to Omar Khadr and all denied to him. And as a result, the international consensus reflected in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and the Charter of the United Nations that no one in the future would fall outside the protection of the law has been overridden and supplanted by lawlessness. And as a signatory to all these international treaties, Canada has an obligation to protest when they are not being applied to one of its citizens. And yet both the Liberal government and the Conservative government refused to uphold its human rights obligations when it came to Omar Khadr. And I say to you, the Canadian governments, both of them, by their actions, demonstrated a shocking, a reckless, and a ruthless disregard for those moral and legal laws that gives effect to the idea of what is fair. And by doing so, by its neglect, it has shown how fragile to each and every one of us here are the laws and their application that we assume are there to protect us, particularly when faced with a government determined to follow a contrary path. History tells us that there are some cases that enshrine the defining moments of their time. Omar Khadr's case is one. Future generations will rightly judge our shocking dereliction of responsibility in this matter and our collective failure to extend justice and humanity. And as we have failed Omar, we've also failed our own children through bequeathing to them an uncertain future as a result of systemic apathy by our citizens and particularly by our civil institutions. And by those I mean legal institutions. By those I mean churches. By those I mean parliamentarians. The civil institutions that are there to help us and protect us while the everyday man and woman gets on with his everyday life of feeding the kids and going to work and picking the kids up. So Omar's story provides, I suggest to you, a frightening lens into the future of democracy and the decline of the rule of law that we talk about gloriously. So embedded in my talk tonight has been the responsibility. And when I say that, I'm talking to you McGill law students. I'm not talking to adults. I'm talking to you. Because it's you that are here to learn how to take on the obligation that's necessary to give us a better world, because we've left it in quite a mess. Our responsibility as human beings, to each and every one of us, is to speak out to the reality of inhumanity and to speak out against the moral hollowness of political inaction. So as I conclude, in my view, whatever that's worth, the only crime equal to willful inhumanity is the crime of indifference, the crime of silence, and the crime of forgetting. Thank you.
Last year in this moot court, we had an event with the judge who was the chief prosecutor for Augusto Pinochet in Chile. And isn't it odd how familiar the description of the mistreatment that we heard today sounds? Because this is exactly what we heard about in the caravan of death and torture and killings in Chile as well as in other parts of Latin America. But there's a big difference. in Chile, the Pinochet abuses are a national trauma and are considered a deep shame that the country could have allowed that to happen. We don't have any such feeling in the United States, and even in Canada, there's a lingering ambiguity about how we feel about Omar Khadr. So I think that this speaks forcefully to a duty that is an individual duty to each one of us, each one of you and me as well, to do what we can in every way, every day, to change that, to challenge that view if you are indeed convinced that this is an injustice. So we have a few minutes, and if you want to intervene, ask questions or for comments, I invite you to advance the microphone. The event is recorded, so we need to have the microphone active, and we can have a quick exchange, and then we will move to a close. So.
Thank you very much. Most of us, I for sure, know very little about the laws of war. Soldiers are killing each other all the time. Soldiers get killed. Civilians get killed. The insidious term collateral damage has entered our vocabulary. Very rarely are these characterized as war crimes, and even far rarely is anybody charged with a war crime. What is the crime that Mr. Khadr was charged with? Could you talk a little bit about the nature of why what he is charged with is considered a war crime? Is this an American law? Is this international law? And what are the elements of that charge? I mean, without going into the evidence of the case, but what are the elements of the law that the American government decided to charge him with?
Thank you. I'm trying to answer. I recall after the... Omar Khadr's trial was the third attempt in Guantanamo to have a trial. The two previous creatures were deemed to be unconstitutional. And it was a case called Hamdan out of the U.S. Supreme Court that overturned and set up a new process. And so I remember asking the judge about what laws are being followed in this forthcoming trial. Is it international law? No. Is it international humanitarian law? No. Is it everyday due process American law? No. Well, is it something in Hamdan I don't understand? And he said, and I have the transcript. He said, Hamdan, he wasn't aware of the Hamdan. What he said, it would just be various regulations and said some numbers. Omar was charged with murder, attempted murder, spying, and all kinds of everyday criminal court offenses. We argued that those offenses were not recognized as international law of war charges. And we were right. Because since then, there have been three former detainees who have gone before the federal court system and argued that very same position. And the federal court has agreed. So where does that leave Omar? Well, almost 2 years ago, we filed briefs appealing the Milton Commission's decision. And what has happened is someone has locked him away in some cupboard and has refused to do anything. And I've written to the Milton Commission a number of times. In fact, I was in Washington just last week speaking to hopefully important people to force the Military Commission in Guantanamo just to make a decision. I know what the decision will be, we'll disagree, but I just need them to make a decision. Once they make a decision, then I'm out of that jurisdiction and I'm now into the federal court system and making that very same argument to those three previous detainees.
Thank you. First I want to underline some of the things you said. I'm going to lower this. Thank you so much for your talk. I was really struck by how boldly you spoke. You said that the ships that brought detainees to Bagram or to Guantanamo are analogous to slave ships, and that the Bagram base is better understood as a concentration camp. I think by your words, you've charged each of us with a moral duty, because now none of us in this room can say we don't know. And if it's true that this is analogous to some of the worst crimes ever committed in human history, then all of us in this room have a very deep obligation indeed. So thank you for that charge. My question is, at the end of your talk, you said that the Canadian government has an obligation to protest when international treaties protecting human rights are violated or not being applied to their citizens. And it strikes me that in much of the way that Omar Khadr was presented in the public, he wasn't really seen to be a citizen. And I wonder if that was part of what helped us perhaps not take his case so seriously, or to allow these things to happen to him. And it reminds me, I'll wrap up with this point, it sort of reminds me of Bill C-51 and how there are arguments being made that it erodes Canadian citizenship, and particularly for folks.
What's your question, please?
So Bill C-51 is eroding citizenship for folks who look like Omar, and I wonder if you would agree that Omar wasn't really seen as a citizen, and that's what made these kind of violations easier, and what that says going forward. If you don't agree, please share.
I have no hesitation in disagreeing. Omar Khadr is a Canadian citizen, born in Canada, with all the rights that are attributed to the citizen. I'm interested in your comment, and I thank you for your question. I hope I wasn't being abrupt, but I just wanted to answer the other questions. When you were going through the list, when I talked about moral duty of all of us, and you don't know if it's true, I'm not making up these stories, not that you accuse me of that. I'm saying to you, there's no excuse for any of us, not knowing about Guantanamo being a Bagram. There are books written about these places. You go on to Google or go on to the internet, there's all kinds of stories. In fact, as time has progressed, more and more people who worked in Guantanamo are coming forward, trying to bare their souls about what they participated in. So we're all complicit through our ignorance. Perhaps we're complicit through our apathy. I had a call from a young lady when the day that Omar Khadr was released, and she said, I'm not asking the question, I think I already have by saying he was a citizen. But what she said was, I heard you talk a number of years ago, and I promised that I would do something. But I didn't. And then the following year, I heard you again, and I made that same promise. And I didn't. And then I went into law school. And I've just come out of the background, Brampton Courthouse, and I've just heard that Omar Khadr is released, and I was crying in my car. And what I said to her, as hard as I may sound to the audience tonight, the same thing I say to you is that it's never too late to stand up for rights. And that's what my talk today is all about. And so there's no excuse for me, there's no leaving excuse for Omar Khadr having not been protected by his own government.
Thank you, Mr. Edney. I guess my question is, having followed the case, you know, from 2008, 2010, and every, you know, degree of litigation, there always comes to be a point where I have accepted, okay, in the 2010 case, there's, you know, obviously the right breach is acknowledged, but the foreign executive is given, you know, power over how it conducts foreign affairs. And then again, you know, when the transfer was being debated in the courts, respect for the prisoner transfer system. So my question is, you know, within the Canadian law itself, there has been so many obstacles to him returning. What are some of, how are those laws to be challenged, and where do you see, where have you felt that same frustration?
Well, I can tell you, I used to laugh when I used to hear American lawyers saying they never lost a case. I thought you must pick and choose some pretty easy cases, and you're not having that. We haven't lost a single case in over 10 years, and I haven't won my car. And that's less to do with my legal skills, and more to do with our judges and our judicial system, which we have to be greatly proud of, which I am greatly proud of. And I did what was the right thing. I challenged excessive power by making our government accountable in a court of law. That's the job. I don't know how else to answer that.
Okay, one last question.
I'm just wondering, I know this isn't so much a fact-specific question, sorry. I'm just wondering, throughout your process, there must have been so many obstacles, and I'm just wondering what kept you going? How did you, because there must have been moments where, I mean, you had no idea how this was going to end, and how did you keep pushing if internally? Like,
I haven't.
Yeah. Well,
well, first of all, let me tell you what the studies is a lonely journey. When we talk about human rights, sometimes I think about it in a degrading kind of way, that it's pretty, it looks good, but it's got nowhere to go. This is the language used by justice and bail arrangers and the public appeal in material. It's always a hard slog. I had no idea that it was going to take so long to do it, and continues to do it. I had no idea. I wanted on numerous occasions to walk away. Why? Because of what it was costing me financially. It was costing me in terms of my time. I'd missed two of my son's graduations and so on. But had I walked away, how do I justify that to myself? I would have had to lie to myself that that kid would be taken care of by somebody else. That maybe they would stop torturing me at one time. And so I couldn't. And so, but I have no stronger moral fiber than anybody else. But I also arrived there with a very strong sense of who I was as a lawyer and what the law means to me. I feel privileged to be having given the title of a lawyer. And so, and I have all my colleagues that I meet, regardless of where we are, we're lawyers, and we're joined in fighting for justice. Irrespective of whether you do real estate law or commercial law, that's why we give this title as law, lawyer. And so you get through it. I wouldn't advise you. I also have had others who worked with me. My co-counsel, Mae Whitley, has always been there with me. He's my junior years ago, and we've been together for many years, even though he has a different practice. I have to say that there were terrible times in Guantanamo, but you get through it because it's the right thing to do. It's as simple as that. And you know what? As I go on, don't feel sorry for me. I'm a much better human being by far through it. I'm a much more stronger lawyer as a result of it. And who else has got a case? Every one of us, I think, should always want to be able to talk. If you're going to become lawyers, you look for a good case or participate with friends in a good legal challenge, something you'll always talk about. I, as a lawyer, can do that. And so, I benefit greatly. Thank you.
So unfortunately, we are pressed for time because there is a class in this room in only a few minutes. So let me give the floor to Jessica Adley to thank Dennis Edney.
I'll be very brief, 1 to 2 minutes. I just want to address Mr. Edney, his wife Patricia, and all of the people who have supported this event very quickly and give you some context as to how it happened. This event happened because Dennis gave me a promise to come to Montreal when I could not promise him anything in return. Since that time, the hosts have come on board, and we've heard from them, and I thank them for their dedication and support. I would like to thank everyone who contributed to a personal GoFundMe page. We've raised over $2,500 to make this event happen. I'm hoping that there will be more of you who will support and donate in any way you can. I realize you're students. I was there a couple years ago. I just want to say it is incumbent upon us as law students, as lawyers, as Canadians, to learn from Omar Khadr's plight to ensure history is never repeated. We all have a responsibility to Omar and to his legal team to allow his legal cases, the injustices, to be put behind him so he can move forward and he can move on. If you would like to support Omar, we urge you to come see us. I am affiliated now with PoorOmar.com. It's up there. It's the official Quebec campaign for Omar, comprised of myself, comprised of Natalie Douin, who's a force to be reckoned with. So I urge you all to introduce yourself to her. And Geneviève Rochette there at the end of the first row. They are incredible women. And all of that to be said, I also want to thank Patricia, who I know, without her and without the Edney family, they could not have supported Dennis in the way that he was supported, and none of this would have happened. They have opened their hearts and home to him, something beyond comprehension for most lawyers, and it is truly incredible. In closing, I just want to point out that to me, Mr. Edney is an example of the finest traditions of the bar, and the Edneys are the pinnacle of what it means to be Canadian. Thank you all for being here.
Yes. you. And I know it's very difficult because I tried your cell, I tried your office, I tried your home.
I hide well.
I know very well. But I was actually going to come to Edmonton in the summertime, just drive or just come there just to visit you and talk to you. I'm from Afghanistan. And the story pinched me from day one, so I just wanted to see how I could help you. And I'm a student here at the faculty. So I was actually going to come, but anyways.
Well, you're welcome for coffee, but if you want to help, help fundraise for the funeral market. That would be a great assistance.
Okay, if that's what you think it is, then that's what I'll do.
Good afternoon.
Hi.
Find yourself. I'd like to thank you very much for reminding me why I got into law. My father was a political prisoner in Ethiopia during the dictatorship. So just want to thank you very much for sharing the journey you have with MR. And I'd like to know if you're also interested in working in human rights abuses, in working in human rights abuses cases in Africa in general?
No, no, not Africa. But we need lawyers in there to fight.
Exactly. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Hey, Dennis. I wrote to you when I was studying in Australia. I practiced law.
Oh, yeah, I know that.
And that was when Australians took that hit. And as shameful as we were to be Canadian, you were representing
him. Hicks sent me a book, his book.
Yeah.
It's worth calling for the day.
I was wondering if I could get a picture of you.
Sure.
Social services.